The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I should welcome all you hearty souls. With the weather we've been having, it feels like Lake Wobegon. My name is Willow Carey, and some of you may know me from WHYY. I was tempted to say how nice it is to be here without a telephone number. But then I thought, now I'm going to make a pitch. WHYY and the Free Library have almost identical missions of lifelong learning, of inspiring curiosity, of providing information and access to the arts and the world of ideas to everyone across our region without paying free of charge. And both institutions rely on the private support of individuals. This is something that you may not typically think of regarding a public library. I am a very proud member of the Free Library's George S. Pepper Society Council and a donor to this great institution. If you value the library as much as I do, I hope you'll join me in making a contribution to the Free Library Foundation. You can do this easily at any amount online at freelibrary.org/support. And tonight's author event with Garrison Keillor is just one example of what your support makes possible. It's a real pleasure for me to be here this evening, as Garrison Keillor's A Prairie Home Companion has been just a fixture, I think. Thank you. On public radio, and you've enjoyed it for more than 30 years on WHYY, which is one of more than 600 stations carrying the program and bringing us all together every Saturday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Sunday from 8 to 10 p.m. It actually is the only live music and variety show aired nationwide today. While most people know Garrison as a celebrated radio host, he's also a novelist. He's written more than a dozen books. He's a songwriter, and he's just written a book of poetry. It's titled, Oh, What a Luxury, Verses Lyrical, Vulgar, Pathetic, and Profound. Isn't that wonderful? He writes, of course, with his characteristic humor and insight on love, on politics, religion, modernity, and a lot of other aspects of our daily lives. His verses are charming and playful, locating sublime song within the humdrum of being human. Please join me in welcoming Garrison Keillor.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all for coming out in this deadly ice storm. I hear that Washington, D.C. shut down on the basis of a light frost on the grass. And so you've shown the East Coast what you are made of. I will refrain from talking about winter in Minnesota. I could, of course. I mean, if there was any demand for that, I could. I could talk about my childhood, and I could talk about coyotes, large coyotes who were not leashed as this animal is, and I could talk about blizzards through which I walked as a child, growing up the middle child of six, which is awkward mathematically and otherwise, and walking through the blizzard, holding on to the clothesline that my father had stretched from the front porch out to the mailbox and then along the line of telephone poles all the way out to the county road for us children to hold on to as we went out to catch the bus. Because nothing was ever canceled in Minnesota. In my childhood, it never was. You could hope for it, but it would never, ever happen. It was like the second coming, you know. It was yearned for by some, but it never actually took place. Because once you would start canceling things in Minnesota, where would you stop? And so that's what I think of when I come into Philadelphia on the train and I hear people talking about this as if this were some sort of crisis. That's fine. We only have a limited supply of crises in our lives, and so we have to make do with whatever ones we have. Because, of course, we all want occasions to rise to the challenge. We are all people who thrive under adversity. Is this not true? Yes, it is. And so, if this is all you get is just a few inches of snow, you've got to make the most of it. Make it into as big a problem as you possibly can. It's a conversation piece. This book, which is out there. First of all, you understand that the book is in your library, and so there's no real need to buy it. It's a very slender book. Even if you took a long time to think about each poem in this book, you could get through this in a couple of hours. So if you see somebody else ahead of you in line who you know, somebody who is buying the book, you know, just wait a couple of days and give them a call. And pass the thing around and save on some trees, although these trees, of course, were cut down a long time ago. This is a collection of poems that were written for Prairie Home Companion, going way back many years. And I never thought of collecting them until I was reminded by Viking Press that I owed them a book. And I said, well, how about this? And they looked at a few of the poems, and they turned them down. And so Morgan Entrekin, who is the man who runs Grove Atlantic, Grove Press, which used to publish, maybe still does, Henry Miller and Tropic of Cancer. I'm now in the same stable with Henry Miller and Eugene Ionesco and Leroy Jones and some of the beat poets, the very mention of whom has made the dog nervous. I did not set out when I was young and ambitious, which I'm not any longer. I did not set out to be a writer of light verse. Light verse, which is generally despised by all serious academics, and certainly is despised by all serious poets. My intention was to be a serious poet, And I just have to point that out to you in my own defense. I thought of serious poets as sort of following the Edgar Allan Poe model, sort of haunted, and as Poe was, in love with dead people. Alcohol, possibly, if possible. Self-destructive, crazed people living on the very brink of insanity, and of course, it would always be a good strategy to die young. So I could sort of imagine that when I was a serious poet, dying young. As Buddy Holly did, flying in that little plane out of Clear Lake, Iowa, or James Dean, or Jim Morrison, or Janis Joplin, all of these heroes of my youth who died young and thereby became immortal. We would not remember them to the extent that we do had they simply retired in their early 20s and gone into teaching geography or become librarians or if they had come to Jesus. And we would not remember them as we do because they died young. So I could imagine that when I was young, I could imagine dying, some accident, and I could imagine people coming and mourning over me, coming and visiting my gravesite, even though it probably would be in Minnesota, and you know, for 4 months of the year, it would be kind of miserable. Actually, six. And mourning for my enormous talent, which I had not had time to fully bring under control. I could imagine all of that. And the problem, of course, was that I wasn't sure that I had that enormous talent. I just didn't seem to me that I did. Some people thought I did because I was quiet and bookish and kept to myself. I didn't make eye contact. I still don't, as you can see. It just isn't a necessity in radio. Nowadays people would say high functioning end of the autism spectrum, but back in the day, people interpreted oddity in a more generous way than we do now. We don't jump all over me for saying this. I'll just say it. I'm probably wrong. But, you know, we do tend to take what used to be considered personality attributes or personality types and assign clinical terms to them and treat them. Back in the day, people were much more free of this sort of labeling. And in a small town, you may be surprised to hear this, but in a small town, there were such odd characters, and they were accepted. They were accepted in all of their oddity, even to some extent loved, because we knew them so well. People who were they to land in a larger community where they would be strangers would have been institutionalized. had crazy people in our town. I didn't intend to be one of them, but we did, and they were protected, if not cherished, they were protected. Anyway, what was I talking about? Early death. There just didn't seem to be the occasion for an early death. I never had to charter a small plane in a snowstorm. As Buddy did, I didn't own a Porsche, you know. I wasn't doing drugs. Drugs were not easy to find in rural Minnesota. Heroin was hard to come by. I wouldn't have known where to go to find it. And so I stayed around because I wasn't sure about my talent. I was interested in being a serious poet, but the poems that were offered to us as examples of serious poetry, I was not particularly moved by. Poe I was, some. "'Twas many and many a year ago in a kingdom by the sea that a maiden there lived whom you may know by the name of Annabel Lee, and this maiden lived with no other thought than to love and be loved by me. She was a child and I was a child in this kingdom by the sea, but we loved with a love that was more than love, I and my Annabel Lee." And you know, even before you get to that point, that she is going to die. And that her death will then ensure his everlasting love. Same as people feel about Buddy Holly or Janis Joplin, Edgar Allan Poe felt about her, Annabel Lee. I liked Poe up to a point. The most famous poem that was pushed on us was the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock, this sort of gloomy, misty poem about a very neurotic hero. You know, shall I wear my trousers rolled? Do I dare to eat a peach? were not problems for most of us. It was hard to sympathize. Later, those of us who were seriously into, who seemed to be English majors, were then assigned to write about T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. Now, when you have a poem that begins with a quotation of six untranslated lines of Italian, this is the poet's way of saying, I know more than you do, and you probably are not going to understand the poem either, and I don't give a rip one way or the other. Not an inviting poem. Frost's poem, "Whose Woods These Are, I Think I Know, His House Is in the Village, Though, He Will Not See Me Stopping Here to Watch His Woods Fill Up with Snow," was probably the most famous poem of the first half of the 20th century. A poem that may have been impressive to Southerners, but to people from Minnesota, the idea of stopping and watching it snow is... is not easy to identify with. What was he doing out there? What is going on? And then at the end, the lines that were quoted by politicians, "The woods are lovely, dark, and deep, but I have promises to keep and miles to go before I sleep, and miles to go before I sleep." Well, yes, you get going. Why are you standing around here? I mean, Your horse doesn't understand it, and neither do we. It didn't register with me. Because I was an English major, I of course could write papers about any of these poems, arguing for them as icons and profound poems and of the pantheon of American poetry. But they didn't move me, really. You learn to be dishonest as an English major. This is what makes English majors so coveted by corporations. The ability to write 2,000 or 3,000 words about a novel which you've only read the book flap of is a useful skill in the corporate world, but it made me uneasy because I'm of that generation, don't you know, that was in search of the genuine, the authentic. What it took us a long time to realize was that the authentic and the genuine were represented by our parents and grandparents. We were running away from them as fast as we could, which is a natural biological fact, but they were the source of authenticity in our lives. Allen Ginsberg's poem, I have seen the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked, walking the Negro streets at dawn, searching for an angry fix, angel-headed hipsters looking for the machinery of night, something. Is a famous poem because the San Francisco police arrested Allen Ginsberg for reading the poem at a reading hosted by Lawrence Ferlinghetti and arrested both of them, put them on trial for obscenity. That was what made the poem famous. Without it, it would have been just an enormous unreadable poem. And now it is a very famous unreadable poem, but when you went to see Allen Ginsberg, very sweet man, dear, generous, lovely, witty, beautiful man, beautiful soul, when you went to see him give a reading, which I did as an undergraduate, after he was about half an hour into it, sitting cross-legged on a stage in a white caftan and sort of strumming, making little chords on a harmonium and chanting, after he was into it for a while, you began to be grateful that you were not sitting in the front row. You had come in late, and so you were standing in back of the auditorium, and you could slip out without any sort of drama, because Allen Ginsberg believed first thought, best thought. He never edited a single thing. And this has made his collected poems one of the largest, bless you, unread poems in American poetry. It's a whole big concrete block of a book. So I didn't go down that road because it just didn't make sense to me. I was an English major. I had to earn a living. I had somehow gotten myself married. And then, as so often happens, we had a child, which we were ill-equipped to parent. And here I was trying to write stories and staying up late at night writing stories, hoping to get published in the New Yorker magazine. And I had to find something that people were willing to pay me to do, and that's how I got into radio. I applied for a job at a station which was then out in the country, out in central Minnesota. It was on the campus of a Benedictine university. And they hired me for one reason, which was that I was reliable, they thought, and that I would get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and be there at 5 to turn the station on, to start up the transmitter, and I would do a music and news and weather program for 6 hours and then do a long newscast, and I would be there. Being there was the crucial part. There was no audition. There was no application. There were no recommendations. They didn't ask anybody about me. I was, as I knew, I was in serious trouble at the time. Other than being married, I was also in trouble with my draft board. I had written them a letter in ballpoint pen on a legal pad telling them why I would not report for induction, as they had ordered me to do on a certain day at a certain hour. And I went into great length. They hadn't asked me, of course, but I told them. And I had then decided that I would rather not die young. And I certainly did not want to die in this miserable and pointless war. I had written them a long letter, and so I was expecting the knock of the FBI on my door. But nonetheless, they hired me, and I went to work. Probably not the smartest thing for a would-be fugitive to do, to go on the air and broadcast under his own name, but it was public radio and nobody was listening. So, and going to work and talking to people at 5:30 in the morning was an education. This was an education you couldn't pay for. It was an education of experience. You realized that the attitudes of irony and a tone of desperation, a dark imagination, symbolism, surrealism, were of no use to you at 5:30 in the morning. People already had enough of that themselves. They didn't need yours. What they needed was somebody who was unreasonably cheerful and somebody who would coax them out of their burrows on a miserable winter morning in Minnesota, dark, dark, overcast, snow forecast, 20 below zero, life-threatening weather. Somebody who would be irrationally cheerful and who would coax them to get dressed, get up. This is life. Everybody's in the same boat. We're all in the same boat. This is not a personal experience. Everybody else is as cold as you are, as miserable as you are. So let's join together. Let's be kind to each other and let's go off and make the most of this day. Miracles are always possible. Even when we are suffering, out of misery can come great beauty. We know this from the lives of artists. This was what they needed, and this was what I needed to do. In order to do it, I had to create a persona for the radio. That was not really who I am. I grew up fundamentalist. And I grew up among people who were waiting anxiously for the second coming and the tribulation and Armageddon, and people who expected the world to end any moment. Okay, it didn't end right then, but hold your breath and it's just about to. Those were my people. I sat under ferocious preaching. That's why I look the way I do. I don't look like a cheery person. So I wouldn't pass muster in television, but I could do this on the radio. And that was where everything originated that I would then wind up doing for the next 40 some years. It was public non-commercial radio, so I wanted to have commercials, of course, and so I invented sponsors, Bertha's Kitty Boutique and Ketchup Advisory Board and Bebop, Rebop, Rhubarb Pie, Rhubarb, The Secret of the Good Life as We Know It, and powder milk biscuits made from whole wheat that give shy persons the strength to get up and do what needs to be done. And Jack's Auto Repair, all tracks lead to Jack's, where the bright flashing lights show you the way to complete satisfaction. Bless you. For the winter months in Minnesota, I had a sponsor called Raoul's Warm Car Service. And if you were in need, you just called Raoul, and he would come up, and the heater would be running, and there would be warm beverages and a comforting driver there to listen to your problems. I needed a place to put these sponsors, and so I invented a town, the little town that time forgot, out in the center of Minnesota, where all the women are strong and all the men are good-looking, and all the children are above average. And I gave it the name Wobegon because it had a double meaning, and it sounded vaguely Ojibwe. And and all of these things just sort of came in a rush for this early morning show, which then I spun out into a Saturday evening show, always with the idea that it was something temporary. To do until I could write the great American novel. And then I realized that slowly, a couple years ago, that many great American novels have been written, and more than just one, and it's unlikely that I am going to write another. And so I have stuck to my hoop stitching. When you get to be this age, young people, the beautiful thing about it is that you can look back on your life and you can get a perspective that you couldn't get decades ago. And you're able to see where your life took this lucky turn. One more reason why I could not be the serious, doomed, tragic poet that I set out to be. Writing poems, I think I wrote a poem when I was in my early 20s. My life is an owl with a wounded wing flying through pitch black toward a spruce tree that does not exist. Nothing you'd read at 5:30 in the morning to people you care about. The other reason I could not be that serious poet is that I had been extremely lucky. And you can see that when you get to a certain point. You look back and you see that your life changed when you dropped a fly ball in right field and people were horrified at this mistake you made, and they turned away. Your friends turned away from you, and they wouldn't look at you, and they didn't slap you on the back and say, that's okay. It wasn't okay. And at that point, your life changed, and instead of trying to win the respect of your peers, you set out to win favor among older people, which is so much easier to do. And you discover that if you walk up to your uncles or your second cousins and you ask them what they were doing during the Depression, what did you do in the war? They were so grateful. And they would tell you. And you got to hear stories. You got to hear your family's history. It was so much more appealing than standing out in right field, which was terrifying. After you saw the price of failure, that was a turn that your life... Nonetheless, I went out for football, or I wanted to, when I was in the eighth grade. But the doctor who gave me the physical put his little stethoscope on my chest and heard a click in the mitral valve, and he said, I can't sign your permission slip. You can't play football. And so, rather than get beat up by older boys as a tackling dummy, I went down the street to the newspaper, and I walked in, a rare moment of courage, and I asked the editor, Warren Feist, if he needed somebody to write sports. This was a little struggling weekly paper. He was the writer, and then the woman behind the counter who sold wedding invitations, Lucille, was the society editor. And that was it. And two linotype operators, pressmen in the back room. Four people worked there. I told him my name. I didn't realize until months later that he thought I was my uncle's son, my dad's brother, who was the president of the bank, and who very likely held a mortgage on the editor's home. My dad worked for the post office and was a carpenter. He had no power whatsoever. So I got in under false pretenses, mistaken identity, but I got to sit in the press box way up high above the bleachers and watch the games and take notes on them and to do real writing and to sit in this privileged place and not sit on the bench down there, my heart pounding for fear I might get thrown into a losing game. I sat up there and I was the god in the skies. My friends in the bleachers would turn and they would wave at me. I ignored them because, you know, I was a professional journalist. I was above that. And I turned in my copy, written out by hand on yellow copy paper to the linotype operators, Whitey and Russ, who sat there. They were drunks, both of them, complete alcoholics, just sitting at these enormous clattering machines, linotypes. They gave off all this heat because they kept the lead melted. So they would clatter out a line, and then they would pull the lever, and the lead would flow into the slug and make the line, and they would go into the galley, and then they would finish the galley, and it would go onto the chase. And I watched them do this, sitting there drinking. They were drinking, I believe, gin, maybe whiskey, out of little Dixie cups. They just sat drinking and drinking and drinking. They were my first readers, and they appreciated what I wrote. And then on Thursday, they set the stories in type on Tuesday, and on Thursday I went in during my lunch hour. School was just around the corner, and I watched them print the paper. Whitey, even though drunk, stood on a stool, and there was an enormous stack of newsprint sheets on a pallet. and he would lift each sheet and just shake it to loosen it, and then he would lay it, swing it out and lay it down onto the flat bed, and the roller would come whoosh ka-chunk and print the paper, which would then slide down pneumatically into the folder, which would trim it up and fold it and bundle it, and you pulled out a paper. And there on page 12 were your words you had written, and your name was on it. And it was waiting there. It was warm in your hands, smelling of fresh ink, waiting for hundreds of people, dozens of people to devour your account of this losing football game. You never get over this. You never, ever recover from this. This marks you for the rest of your life. You have now found what you are going to do somehow, given any sort of luck, for the rest of your life. I was, the year after, was kicked out of shop class by Mr. Beeler because I was dreadful in shop. I had flunked plywood. I had flunked ball peen hammer. I had flunked sheet metal. I couldn't make a flour scoop for my mother. I was just clowning around and violated a basic rule of shop, which is you do not sit down on a shop bench. You do not do this. I did. And I sat down on a bench that had acid on it. And it ate through my pants slowly. And they had to give me a shop apron to wear, turn backwards, which I didn't mind that much, but the principal, Mr. Klonowski, got on Mr. Beeler, and Mr. Beeler said, there's no point in you staying in this class. I mean, all you do is talk, so we're going to send you upstairs to Miss Pearson's speech class. And they sent me up, out of the basement, out of the smell of solder and wood shavings. Where my father would have had me stay, I was sent up to the second floor to Miss Pearson's speech class, where you stood on a stage just almost exactly like this. And you stood right in the middle of the curve, and you looked out, but without a microphone, you looked out onto your classmates, and you ignored them because they were rolling their eyes, and they were... And they were pulling invisible things out of their nostrils, some of them would let saliva just. So you didn't want to look at them. You looked at Miss Pearson, who stood in the back of the room. She was young. She was in her early 20s. She'd just gotten out of college. She was sort of bouncy, and she wore her hair in a ponytail, kind of a dirty blonde color. And she wore corduroy jumpers, dark blue, green, white blouse, gold chain around her neck. And she had the most beautiful smile. And she stood back there and she smiled at you as if this were the most wonderful thing she had ever heard anybody do on a stage. And her smile follows you for years, follows you for the rest of your life. And, through bad shows, I've done a lot of bad shows, and I'm sure you don't disagree with me, but that smile follows you all of your life. That marks you. You see these lucky turns that your life took. And you're no longer able to write about your life as you should, if you're a serious poet, as a life of pain. There just is not any plausible way in which to do this. You realize, coming to this advanced age, that the persona that you created, that wrote these stories and that does this radio show is something you inherited from your parents. They were fundamentalists, but they were children of the Depression, and that was more important, I think. And so they believed in cheerfulness as a way of life. They came of age, my mother and father, they came of age at a time when everyone was short on money, everyone they knew. And everyone was uncertain about the future, especially towards the end of the 30s. My parents had their first child in 1937 and the next in 38. I was born in 42. And there was great uncertainty that attended all of this. My people were cautious people. They were people who always bought day-old bread. They were people who slaughtered their own chickens, though we were the only people in the neighborhood who did, and others looked on us as barbarians, but nonetheless, they did because they believed in make do, use it again. And they would drive round town all over looking for cheaper gasoline to a couple pennies per gallon off. They were looking for that bargain. They believed in cheerfulness as a choice. And once I got out of the vapors of adolescence, I did too. I do. I believe in cheerfulness as a choice. Whatever the circumstances of one's life, people nonetheless make this choice every day of their lives, how they want to be. We're all subject to we're all subject to trouble, all kinds of trouble, and nobody is beyond this. But we still can choose to be cheerful. And my people were. My mother, in her mid-90s, she lived to be 97, and towards the end of her life, the very end of her life, she slipped into what my siblings referred to as dementia. She was the last of her family of 11 children, to last survivor, the last leaf on the tree. They were all gone. And she was alone. She had no contemporaries left at the age of 97. And that was when we started to find her. She lived in her own home until the very end, with some help. And we would come and we would find her talking to people who were not there, which troubled my siblings. She was talking to her deceased brother George and to Ina and to Elsie, the siblings that she was closest to. And if you listened carefully to her, in the midst of this gibberish, you could sometimes hear their names. And she was telling stories. And I could tell by the cadence of her voice that these were jokes. And she would laugh. She would sit there and laugh, which really bothered my sister. Really bothered her. And she thought we should up the dosage of Ativan. No, I said, Ativan is very useful for anxiety, but this is mother telling stories to the only people who would understand her. They're dead. They're not here. What she's doing is not so different from what I do on the radio every Saturday. My mother said in a moment of clarity about 6 months before she died, she said, there is so much I still want to know and there is nobody left to ask, which is the predicament of longevity. But they were cheerful people. Happiness is something else. That's something that you don't have control over. it seems to me. And some people do, are blessed with happy lives, but not necessarily the result of their own actions. Joy is a theological concept. I don't know that it actually exists, but maybe, I don't know. I don't know anybody who lives in a state of joy myself. Contentment, I don't think so. Not Americans. I think we're always out for something and eager and wanting, looking to the next opportunity and restless and acquisitive. Euphoria, I don't know. Bliss, short-lived. I read somewhere, 10 seconds on the part of the male, 15 seconds on the part of the female. Euphoria, I think I experienced once when I had a wisdom tooth extracted. And I go back, you see, to the age of painful dentistry, where the dentist was a kind of a odd character with sort of greenish eyes and bad skin and hair problems, and he would climb up on your lap with a pair of pliers, and he would fight you for that tooth, and he would win, and your pain did not make a lot of difference to him. I went in. So the term, you know, wisdom tooth extraction to somebody of my generation is a synonym for abject suffering. And the moment you mention it to somebody else my age, you know, their pity is elaborate. But you go in and here's an oral surgeon, and he's very cheerful, and he asks you if you would like a sedative. Well, sure. Why not? One is so seldom offered these things. And so poke a little tube in the crook of your elbow, and the liquid drips from the bottle on the pole, and you are in this dreamy state. You are in this plastic world, this fluid world, and hard edges do not occur in this world. You are drifting and floating, and you are buoyant, and they take you into what they call a recovery room. Recovery from what? Nothing to recover from. You sit there on this leather recliner, and they've done something. You're vaguely aware of something has happened, but it didn't really concern you. And a nurse asks if you are okay. My gosh, you've not been this okay in a long time. And now you realize what your nefarious friends were in search of back in the 60s, smoking those evil tarry leaves and mushrooms and those little powders on mirrors and rolled up dollar bills and all of that. But it's not for us. Not for us. Chemical euphoria does not end well. We know this. Our ancestors are telling us this whenever we're tempted in that direction. No, 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 no. We are sensate human beings, and we're meant to experience life in all of its variety. We get a few passes now and then. And I do have three more wisdom teeth. So there is something to look forward to, but that is the limit. Everything has a limit. I was going to get around and talk about this this book, and why haven't I? I'm sort of talking around it and explaining what's behind it. So I have written this book, which begins with the limerick, the classic limerick. There are a number of them in the book, and I have done my best to add to them. And goes on from there. Lyrics and rhymed metrical verse and the sort of poetry that serious people do not write anymore. And if you should meet somebody who has bought a copy and you borrow their copy, I certainly hope you enjoy it. Are there any questions in this fine group here? Yes, I saw a hand go up over here. I can just walk down here. You can whisper it in my ear, and then I'll know if it's who. Somebody raised their hand. Oh, there you are.
First, thank you for so many years of Prairie Home Companion and what my grandmother... which has provided what my grandmother called belly laughs. You have provided many belly laughs. I was curious as to whether, with all the humorous, mildly irreverent jabs you have taken at the Lutheran Church, if you ever got into trouble for that.
What sort of trouble could Lutherans cause? What are they going to do? Are they going to deny me lutefisk? Are they? No, you see, they are modest Christian people, and this obligates them to be tolerant and to be accepting, and so they are in a position where they cannot cause me trouble. I can't even imagine Lutherans as troublemakers. I can't put those two things together. No, they're forced because they are Midwesterners. The ones I'm talking about are Midwesterners, and they are Lutherans. They're forced to pretend to enjoy this.
I also wondered if you were aware that the oldest Lutheran church is about 35 miles from here, Augustus Lutheran Church, the oldest one in...
Augustus Lutheran, really? Why would they name it for a Roman emperor? This sounds like a Roman branch of the Lutheran Church. Is there a lot of statuary in this church? No? No? Candles? No? Pictures of saints? No? Augustus. So, well, they're probably Swedes, aren't they? Yeah. I'll bet they're Swedes. Oh, Germans. Okay. All right. No, I know they made a landing here on the East Coast, eventually they gravitated towards the inland. It just seemed safer to them. They always went where they had relatives. Yes.
Since you've done a movie and you've been having your show for so long, what's left for you to explore on Prairie Home Companion?
What is?
What's left for you to explore?
Oh, lots of things. I want to write a play. I'm trying to write a play right now, and I've promised it to a theater by January 1st, and I'm not that far into it, but something will happen. No, there are a lot of things. There are a lot of things left to do. I think that as the music business changes, there are so many brilliant young performers and songwriters who who desperately need a place, and I think radio is a perfect place for them. We had Nellie McKay on the show last Saturday, and I just think she's so amazing, so much fun. She's a gorgeous, gorgeous, gorgeous singer. So we stay in business for people who we imagine need us. Somebody raised their hand back here. Oh, yes.
I've never been a terribly, well, not at all a great fan of poetry, although I love to listen to it when it's recited on the radio. I particularly enjoy the quality of your voice, but I'm wondering what's the best way, in your opinion, for people to become more comfortable with poetry? Is it better to read it out loud, or to have someone read it to you, or just to read it quietly? Just if you're trying to develop some affinity for it. It's not... It just looks like prose to me.
Well, you may be right. Maybe you just have not found the right person. You know, there's a lot of... You can't talk yourself into loving something. I think poetry is an intuitive art, and you just need to find the people that you care about, and then they will lead you to other people who you care about. If you think of beautiful speech, you think of beautiful speech that you would think of memorizing so that you could hear the words come out of your own mouth. What would you think? What would you think of? Anything? Plays? Poetry? When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state. You following me?
Yes.
And trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and think upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least, yet in these thoughts myself almost despising. Haply I think on thee, and then my state, like to the lark at break of day, arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate, for thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings that I would scorn to change my lot with kings. You recite that to somebody, and you beware of who you recite that to, because when you do, they will marry you, and... This may or may not be what you really want. Yes, ma'am.
When you were talking about how you were hired for NPR, it brought back memories because I was that person in Missoula, Montana. And one of the most indelible memories I have of that time is when that small staff of us got together and listened to a demo tape in Missoula, Montana of A Prairie Home Companion.
I didn't know we did a demo tape.
Trust me. And it really warmed my heart to hear you talk about I was the only person with no car who had to walk 25 minutes one way across railroad tracks to turn on Big Volte at 5:30 in the morning, and then discover that the reason that my thighs looked like liver was because it was 70 below zero. And you're right, there's a fantasy that you indulge in and you're able to share with your audience, and I appreciated the fantasy you brought us here tonight.
Thank you.
Thank you.
thank you again. I wanted to ask a little bit about changes in media technology. How do you feel that as media technology changes over time, do you feel that makes an impact on your programming and on what you do, and why or why not?
I think that we sort of exist outside of that, and social media, I think, are sort of playthings. I don't take them seriously. Other people do, but I don't. I do the show for people who are listening right at that time. I realize it goes out on other platforms. It goes out in a podcast. You know, people listen to it on little buds, and it's online. You can find anything you want on YouTube. I realize all of that, but I still do the show for people who are listening on Saturday in real time, and I do it for truck drivers, over the road truck drivers, and I do it for families that are driving off someplace for the weekend and their children in the car and they're not getting along, and I do it for prison inmates who listen to the show. I do it for people who listen to it in foreign countries. It's broadcast in New Zealand and Australia and the UK and on Armed Forces Network. I do it for people who you know are living out on the desert in the Middle East and for whom America is this beautiful fantasy off in the distance. But I do it for those classic listeners and new media. It doesn't seize my imagination. So Saturday night, you know, we'll do the show live. We're standing on a stage in Midtown Manhattan, and it's 6 o'clock, and the stage manager gives you the big high sign, and the piano starts to play. I think of people who are listening right then, and that's all I can think about. All right. I'm sure there are people over on the left who have questions. Yes, the man who owns the dog.
Well, I'm proud to say I'm on the left, and I want to thank you very much for the Writer's Almanac. There's a lot of poetry that is not in Braille, and this is a way that I get a lot of new poems. So thank you. I wanted to ask you how you. Sort of what a typical week looks like for you. I'm thinking about how you integrate the writing life plus the rehearsal schedule, the traveling. So how do you fit that all together and balance all that?
Not well. You don't want to know, really, you don't. You would think that somebody my age would have mastered this by now. And I find it impossible to master it. I write Prairie Home Companion. I write the show, and I write it in a panic. I start on Thursday, and Thursday afternoon or somewhere, and I make a little bit of a start, and then I work furiously on Friday. I put in a 12-13 hour day on Friday. And there's a read-through with the actors at the end of Friday. And you go to the read-through, and with few exceptions, it's just a mess. It's just an absolute mess. And just nothing sounds good at all. And so you go home Friday, and you stay up late, and you get up early in the morning on Saturday, and you just work rewriting the whole thing. It all has to be rewritten. Writing is rewriting, and that's just the long and the short of it. And nothing comes out right the first time. I'm sorry, Allen Ginsberg, but it just is how it is. And So, but sometimes, you know, like last Saturday, it turns out better than you had any reason to hope that it would. Yes.
Thank you.
I think of three people who can make me visualize what they're talking about. You, Gene Shepherd, and my dinner with Andre. And in light of what you just said, have you ever done a show cold where you didn't rehearse it or you lost the notes or whatever? And if so, could anybody tell the difference?
Well, I would know the difference. I'm a writer, and I believe in writing as a way of thinking. It's how you think if you are of that persuasion, and you put things down on paper, reserving for yourself the freedom to do something entirely different, but you've started the process when you write, and that's crucial. I think that if you did it cold, what you would be most likely to do is to fall back on old material. And when you've been doing the show as long as I have, you have a lot of stuff up in your head that you could easily tap into. And you don't want to. You want to break through that, the easy stuff, and you want to find something new, and you do that by writing, I think. I don't believe in improv. I know that other people do, and maybe they do it brilliantly, but I just don't believe in it. I think that it falls into very simple patterns, and it also takes a long time. Okay, one more question. Yes, this distinguished man here.
One way to have heard what you said about the beginning of the creation of the persona that we've come to know and love was that it was forged at 5 o'clock in the morning in the Benedictine College. Almost a creation to be what that audience needed that was not where your darker side was, right? Do you ever, now that you've been in it and it's become so accepted, do you ever wish you could escape that persona? Other than by wisdom to the extraction.
Well, my wife would say that I do escape that persona. And that I, you know, escape it fairly regularly. No, I escape that persona when I'm around the house. I become a very quiet person. I become my wife would say, an often uncommunicative person. I am not a good guest for your dinner party. I sit and listen to other people, and I remember things that they say, and I use them. So my relatives are wary of telling stories. They clam up when I'm around. A last question now. You.
Really? Thank you. You.
This has to be just a great question.
No, the pressure.
To the source of life.
You mentioned that we over here are on the left, and you don't usually talk directly about political questions, but would it be fair to assume? No. Tell me how you deal with your political ideas and beliefs in the context of a non-political show.
Well, we have a guy who does impressions, and he does a pretty good Barack Obama. Barack Obama is a really interesting voice. There's a little bit of Midwestern, there's a little bit of Hawaii, there's a little bit of black preacher in his voice. It's an interesting voice. And so we use that ever so often. George W. Bush was much more fun. You just did a kind of a dry nasal laugh, and people recognized him right away. And he was a source of many malapropisms. President Obama, not so much. I guess I don't find a basis for satire that I really trust. I don't trust myself. I don't trust my own political biases. You know, I'm just a museum quality Northern liberal, and I'm just an old Northern liberal, my convictions are, you know, not really based on personal experience that much. You know, I bought them somewhere, third hand. So, you know, the older you get, I think this is just true, the older you get, the less, you know, the less confident you become in your own wisdom. I am confident in sort of, you know, sort of wisdom about life, you know. But I'm a long way away from Washington, really. And so most of what I know is borrowed and sounds good, but I don't like people at dinner parties who carry on about politics. My friends are mostly Democrats, and that makes it even less bearable for me to listen to all this. I'd rather hear about experience. So I'll leave you with wisdom rather than politics. Things you learn by the time you get to be my age. You learn that tall people cannot count on short people to take care of things that we would bump our heads on. The cupboard doors, the pots hanging from over the island, the cooking island. You have to take care of that yourself. And as much as you curse when you bump your head, you know, for the 85th time this week, it's pointless. You have to look after this yourself. Great things can be done in small increments. And you don't need to take a year off to go off and do it. If you just, and I've tried this, if you keep a dish by your back door and you come home and you put your car keys and your mobile phone and your extra glasses all there and you put them all in that bowl, with the time you save, you can write a novel. You can. Be careful who you make fun of, because you are likely going to become that person. We grew up, boys in my high school who were oddball. We loved Jonathan Winters, the comic, and we learned his voice that he did for the old lady, Maud Frickert, and that sort of tremulous, cracked, "Hi, old lady" voice. Now we've become that person. You become the objects of your own satire, your own parody. And the way to get along is with people you live with is always to have more fun. That's my principle. Talking about the relationship with the other person only digs a deep hole for yourself. And you want to stay away from that.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.